On this week's episode of Out of Oscar, I am joined by Owen Daly to once again discuss a Patricia Highsmith adaptation, The Talented Mr. Ripley, a nominee at the National Board of Review, Globes, Critics, and the BAFTAs, plus that film's surprise omission from the stacked 1999 Best Picture race.
Dickie Greenlee? It's Tom. Tom Ripley.
Tom Ripley?
We were at Princeton together.
Did we know each other? Sorry, what is it?
Ripley.
How do you do?
It'll just be for a little while.
No, I like him.
Marge, you like everybody.
Marge, you like everybody.
You stay at Dickie's house, eat Dickie's food, wear his clothes.
And his father picks up the tab.
What did you actually do in New York?
Telling lies, forging signatures, impersonating practically anybody.
What?
Hello, Owen. Welcome back to Out of Oscar. We're doing another Patricia Highsmith adaptation. Do you have a preference? Have you read the book? That's a good starting question.
I haven't read the book this time.
Oh, you have read The Price of Salt for Carol.
Yeah.
Well, you were one of the first guests to approach me for the second season and an idea for a film. And you mentioned The Talented Mr. Ripley, Anthony Minghella's film from 99. Anything that stuck out in particular, why you wanted to choose the film for discussion? The thing that you messaged me was very funny about it having like cast at their peak hotness. Any other reasons why you chose Talented Mr. Ripley?
Yeah, I mean, I really love the film and I think about it a lot, and I was just kind of looking for an excuse to talk about it. And it wasn't until I suggested it that I kind of thought of the connection between this and Carol, obviously with it being an adaptation of Highsmith. And also, as I said, the peak hotness of all the main four.
Film of the moment, in that you can definitely sense where Miramax is coming from, the cast that they've selected, who they're trying to catapult and who they already have in some instances. Before we dive in, I'll just give a brief summary of the film if you're not familiar with it. In late 1950s New York, which is an interesting way to start this because most of it's in Italy, Tom Ripley, a young underachiever, is sent to Italy to retrieve Dickie Greenleaf, a rich and spoiled millionaire playboy. But when the errand fails, Ripley takes extreme measures. Yes, extreme measures, puts it mildly. Essentially, he turns to murder. Is this a film that you revisit for the summer? I just love reading letterbox reviews of people saying that they go back and watch this every summer. This is their vacation movie, if you will.
I think this is my third time seeing it. I don't necessarily make it a yearly tradition. And I probably think about it yearly whenever the name comes around, because it's kind of hard not to think about it because there's so much there to ingest. So I'm definitely not one of the yearly revisitors of this. I think I would have to be a bit psychotic to want to experience this character's journey every year.
Sure. Yeah, my journey with the film is a bit strange. I remember my classmate in English class, maybe like year 11, was like, oh, I watched Talented Mr. Ripley last night. That was weird. Wasn't expecting that. And I used that as like a hook to actually watch the film. And I almost gave up about midway because I just wasn't sure where it was headed. I went in completely blind. And I will say the film does have a pacing problem, but I did stick with it to the end and was shocked. It is a very shocking film. But this is my second time watching it. And I will say the flaws from the first time still exist the second time around. But overall, it's a very successful film. Like, it's a feast of scenery. It's a very rich and thorough adaptation. But yeah, like, this is a film that you can't really stay too mad at. Like, it has some some things going for it, some things that hold it back. But overall, like, it is a good film.
Yeah. I mean, we will talk about things that maybe we disagree on. You will get to it with the Oscar nominations, I guess. It's just kind of, it's kind of hard for me to think of the negative because there's just so much there to really enjoy, whether it's the design, the performances, just Minghella totally understanding the world that this novel is set in and kind of really making it so big, but also at the same time so small.
I think this film was the 26th highest grossing of 99, which perhaps maybe, like, if you brought a huge set of stars in nowadays, would be able to pull off. I don't know why the first thing that came to my mind was House of Gucci. I don't know if these are particularly comparable. It definitely feels like a studio picture of the time. And we are all aware of the backstory of Miramax. But the films that they did create in the 90s feel almost like time capsules, almost if like the 90s, although 20 to 30 years ago is period. I really want to get into like the kernel of Dickie or Tom or whatever his name is, Matt Damon's character, of the sort of reckless jealousy that he experiences. Was this always lying underneath, do we think? And although we don't necessarily always need prequels or sequels, would you have liked to seen an extension on the manipulation of said Tom Ripley?
I mean, I'm not sure about the jealousy component in terms of their past, because we obviously don't fully know what their past together was, simply based on the later scene where we find out that Tom didn't actually attend Princeton and instead was helped with the music department. I guess a prequel would be interesting, but I always kind of like the unknowingness of certain parts that happen before the movie begins. And I think, based on just how, in general, prequels are kind of very disappointing, I like the kind of question mark that you're left with about Tom and Dickie before this movie.
Yeah, you know, the explanation behind, you know, why he's doing this doesn't really need to be justified. I think anti-heroes or just villains can exist as is. And we have like a plethora of characters that we get to see him bounce off and how he interacts with people. And he interacts with everyone and they all have big personalities, Freddie Miles in particular, in the same sort of way. Like he's been very like logical about lying, if that makes sense. But you definitely get a sense of where his character lies. I mean, I think, I don't know if, because I'm not like the hugest fan of Damon's interpretation. I think he plays it a bit too wide-eyed and almost childish in some scenes. When he's with Dickie in the jazz club, he looks like a preppy little schoolboy, like getting excited over the songs. I think so far as like just absorbing or just reveling in sociopathic tendencies that you want to stay like 10 feet away from, it's a very kind of fascinating and eye-catching film. And the cast is spectacular. And I want to talk a little bit more about them. Do you have a favorite performance in the film or one that you particularly are compelled by? And I have a feeling it's going to be Jude Law.
I mean, I'm very much compelled by every one of the cast members in this, but if forced to choose one, I'd have to go with Jude Law. I think it's just, again, it's a time capsule of Jude Law in this age of when he was performing. And I think he just kind of, he makes such like a grand, like he's such a presence that he's all you kind of watch while you're also watching the rest of the movie when he's on screen. And then once he leaves, spoiler, not really. And once he leaves, you still are thinking about him because you're viewing, you remember his presence in the film, but you're also sort of seeing him in Matt Damon, who's kind of trying to impersonate elements of Dickie throughout. It's just the performance that has always stuck with me.
He has a real charisma. I think that's the good way of putting it, because Tom Ripley / Dickie Greenleaf is always trying to grasp charisma or grasp like a tangible sort of charm that is always intangible, because he just lacks the element that Jude Law's Dickie Greenleaf just inherently has. I think we'll move on to Kate, because Kate Blanchett in this film is like, she just, I think it's so obvious at this time that she's just going to like elevate any role that she has. She was sort of in prestigious, well, it's sort of early on in her career, but at the time she had done Elizabeth, and Talented Mr. Ripley would have been sort of like her foray into prestigious pitches that she sort of kept throughout her entire career. Like, she's always had the stage thing, but she knows the type of films that she wants to be in, especially around that era. Her character is funny to me, because it's like she's informed, like, say the person of Meredith has informed their mannerisms and their behavior and their privilege and their status off like the silver screen, which I find just like hilariously meta.
I do like that Blanchett is, you can always tell when she's playing these kind of characters, as you said, she's inspired by the idea of film history. And I think she does the same in Carol with her kind of inspirations from classic kind of 1950s leading women. And then this time kind of approaching that similar type of performance. But I think it's never, she understands, I think, the performance and the actor giving the performance. It's not necessarily that type of inspiration where it seems lazy and they don't fully understand kind of every aspect of the performance. I think she's always so great to watch when she does show up. The more times you watch her, it's hard not to enjoy her work.
You would find yourself in an interesting place in most of those actors' careers. But I try to put myself in the shoes of like 99. I would be extremely young. But looking at the film and thinking, okay, where are these actors going to go? And you sort of think in the context of Paltrow and Damon's career. But I would watch this film and think, there's no way that this actor should ever be in a supporting role anymore. Like, there's a reason why Kate Blanchett is like a leading star. She has enough pizzazz to lead a film, to carry a film. And I think she really does carry this film when it sort of mellows out in the halfway point. And she has an intoxicating screen presence. And I wanted more of Meredith. I really wanted to know what happened after she leaves that cafe. She walks away with like the wardrobe informing every bit of her character, which is very similar to what she did in Carol, where almost like a twirl of the wig just meant so much. I was left a little bit underwhelmed by Gwyneth Paltrow even again this time. It's interesting. She's just come off the back of a leading actress win against Kate Blanchett, but she's winning for Shakespeare in Love, another Miramax film. And there's something just so disingenuous about herself in this film, the way she interprets Marge. I know she's definitely playing into that like East Coast privilege sort of sensitivity and daintiness, and she's even doing like a weird transatlantic accent, at least I picked up on in some scenes.
Paltrow is definitely the divisive one of the cast members, I find, when people talk about this film. I mean, I really enjoy her work here and think her kind of disingenuous is very much present in a lot of the main characters. I think the reason why this film works for me is Tom slash Dickie is so kind of bad at being a liar, but also he's very discovered of being a liar because everyone in this film is lying about everything. Mm-hmm. And I think marriage plays into that. And I think Paltrow, she's definitely going big in certain moments. But I think about the scene, like the one where Dickie is intimidating her in the bathrobe. I mean, it's a very big emotional swing. But for me, it works because I think maybe I enjoy Paltrow more as a performer at this time. I am definitely one of the big fans of her Shakespeare in Love work. And I think this was a great follow-up.
But it also doesn't feel like a big interpretation. It feels like she's approached it with a simple mind, but she's also playing it like very complicated, in a very complex way. Do you think that she should have been a bigger player in the supporting actress race of that year?
I mean, she makes my supporting list from that year, so yes.
Oh, interesting. I know I asked this of a lot of my guests, but do you have a favorite scene or favorite moment or something that just like ties the film all together or out of context, clues you into the film? Because my one is when they're in the jazz club and they're singing To Val Americano. Incredible, incredible accent right there. You sort of pick up on how quickly Tom can pick up on things. He's heard the song for just 30 seconds, we assume, and he's already picked up on the lyrics and the tempo and the beat. And I think that's it's funny because he's very clumsy, but he's very like skillful at just picking up on the right things and just getting by. Like most of the things that he does in the film are just a complete fluke, but I really like that scene in particular and the meaning behind that song. A humorous song about an Italian man in the 50s who wants to imitate the American lifestyle he sees in the movies. But then it says, American food doesn't do him any good. And in the end, the money he spends comes from his mother's purse. It's just great. And it's also just a good song. It's that sort of thing that I just like love from 90s movies. Just those random song breaks that like in non-musicals that are just like really great to revisit. Miramax strangely has a lot. I'm thinking of The Crying Game as well. That break into, well, the song that's sung in the club. But what about you?
I mean, there's so many scenes to like, and trying to think of the initial one that fully like understands the film. I think the first meeting of Dickie, Marge, and Tom on the beach, I really enjoy. I mean, there's a lot to see but on the screen, but I think that scene kind of, for me, puts how Tom is trying really hard to put across this image. And then even when he leaves, you find out how kind of bad he is at it when you hear Marge and Dickie sort of talk about him. And I think that's the scene that really puts across what the film for me is going for, where we are seeing and witnessing everything that Tom is doing, but we are also seeing and witnessing everyone's reactions and not fully believing him, whether it's Dickie, whether it's Freddie, whether it's Marge at the end. I think if Meredith spent more time around Tom, she would be on the same boat. I think the reason she's so unknowing of everything is because she doesn't spend a lot of time around him versus everyone else who has been around him for a long time and straight away sort of sees the faults in Tom's performance of this lifestyle.
And that's why I love Freddie Miles' character so much, who only on the second meeting calls out basically his BS. But that's a really fascinating sort of side of the film, in that you watch the characters and they really do believe that Dickie has just up and vanished and he's still alive somewhere. He's just hiding from Marge, hiding from his engagement, the responsibilities. But yeah, that's why I really like Cate Blanchett's Meredith, because she's so unknowing. And it's almost like hilarious that they speak as if everything is okay and normal, and that they're not talking to a brazen sociopath who also has murder tendencies. Straying a little bit further away from that, is it like a common thing to say that Jude Law is the most attractive person has been in film? Is that like, I hear that a lot.
I mean, he's definitely in this film one of, like, it's a very attractive moment in his career for him. And the film is kind of in love with him and really shoots him very attractively. So I could understand the agreement. I mean, there are so many films throughout history that capture their actors in very attractively. But then, I mean, I'm trying to think of examples of very attractively shot people who are nice, because the only other one I can think of is, say, a Brando in Streetcar, who is very attractively filmed, but is such a kind of horrible person that you don't want to almost appreciate how hot he's captured on film.
And I also think the timeless wardrobe plays a part, or just like the summer style. You still get like on the anniversary of Talented Mr. Ripley's release, like Vogue will release some article about like, oh wow, the ineffable summer style of Talented Mr. Ripley and how well the cast were dressed. You can count on Vogue, France, Spain, Italy, the US to release an article about that.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think the Academy ignored it in higher regard? The only thing I can really think about is it stemming down to Miramax funneling their money towards the Cider House Rules for whichever reason. Maybe they deemed it more approachable. Perhaps they were concerned or interested in making the young stars of that film, Tobey Maguire and Charlize Theron, if I'm correct, into profitable actors. We know that Miramax had their moment at the Oscars the prior year, and that Matt Damon and Gwyneth Paltrow have won for Miramax films. So perhaps they were just switching their campaign to prioritize that film. It's really the only thing I can think of, though, it all coming down to where the studio prioritized themselves, because they did buy their nominations. That's not new. So we can always count on Miramax doing that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the topic of the film is very dark, and the film doesn't shy away from it. And I guess at the time, voters are much better, I think, nowadays in approaching very dark subject matters than maybe they were at this time. I mean, sorry, dark subject matters and how just to the point they're filmed, like in this versus the Cider House Rules, where it's much more wholesome and kind of boring and blah, versus this, where it's like, it's really showing you a lot and not afraid to show you everything.
Mm-hmm. I also thought about that. And I also thought about like the prototypes or like the roles that the Academy expected from the cast in that film, and perhaps it not aligning with how they viewed Matt Damon fresh off Good Will Hunting, and yes, finding that character very unlikable. To have, it's such a shame, because we think of like what the Academy's role is in appreciating film, and if they're scared away from dark subject matter, perhaps there's a little bit of homophobia playing into this. This film is very heavy on the homoerotic underlings that appear in Highsmith's novel, whereas, like, say, the 1960 film is very light on that. That's also maybe plays into it. But do you think that Talented Mr. Ripley suffers from the expectations built up being from being Minghella's like follow-up project to his Best Picture winner, The English Patient?
I mean, I love the film, so I don't fully understand the kind of disappointed reactions maybe that people have suffered. But I think because when you think about it as a follow-up to English Patient, it's such a different film. It's much more kind of dark, colder and darker than English Patient was. English Patient kind of had, similar to maybe a Cider House Rules or a Green Mile, had that dark subject matter, but in a much more, for lack of a better word, a mainstream way where bigger audiences could enjoy it.
Yeah, it is a suave and fashionable film, but it is ultimately very detached and leaves you with quite an unfulfilling feeling at the end, not necessarily in how the plot is portrayed, but in like the emotions that it leaves you with. He's almost so close to having the connection with someone who somehow somehow is able to praise Tom Ripley. Like, you know, I don't see it, but if he does, great. And then he ultimately murders him. And then we're back at the beginning, which is such a Minghella thing. The English Patient does the same thing. But this film is no English Patient. I think that really plays into the Academy's taste. And it's also interesting that Minghella went through the same thing with Cold Mountain, which we're going to discuss on this pod. So I think it's maybe Minghella is able to craft really great adaptations, but sometimes just people are left wanting a little bit more and critics are left wanting a little bit more, because I did read a lot of mixed negative reviews of this film. Some points that I agree with and some points that I think are completely just wrong. But, you know, I want to move on to this little segment that we're going to be doing. So in this segment, we are going to compare the two major adaptations of The Talented Mr. Ripley by Patricia Highsmith, this one from 1999, and Purple Noon or Plein Soleil from 1960, which is directed by René Clément. So Purple Noon is an interesting one, definitely less exposition and less material, or it feels like less characters than The Talented Mr. Ripley. But let's go off comparing them. Okay, between the two, which film has the better wardrobe?
I'd have to say Ripley has the better wardrobe. I think Anne Roth is the costume designer.
Yes, I would say, well, Purple Noon definitely has an advantage because it's in the era, so it's not period designs. I really do like that pinstripe jacket though in Purple Noon, so I'm actually going to say that one has the better wardrobe. Both films are positioned or sold as thrillers or suspenseful thrillers, if you want to even go the extra mile, Netflix and their keywords for everything. Which film has the better thrills?
It depends, because obviously they're made in such different times. Like, the 60s version can't show as much as the 90s can, based on just when it came out. And I guess I'll go with Purple Noon based on how its thrills are thrilling while understanding how limited they were and what they can show. Not to say that the 90s version doesn't have great thrills. I think just in terms of this comparison competition, I will choose Purple Noon this time around.
Sure. That the opera scene in the 90s version, I think, is a bit comparable to in the 60s version when he's eating at the restaurant and the dance troupe shows up and he has to sort of navigate around there. But that opera scene when he's run into everyone that he knows in Italy and they all ask him questions about Dickie, and then Meredith is there and that will give something away. That is just has me clenching my jaw. It's too much. It's like, dude, what are you doing? Like, let this go. This is stressing me out. So in terms of like thrills, I find that thrilling. The murders are definitely much more like shocking in the 99 version, but like more upsetting in the 60s version. Yeah. Who is the better Tom Ripley? Alain Delon or Matt Damon?
Problematic actors.
Truly. Yeah.
I think Damon. I love Damon's work in this. He's an actor who I don't necessarily love a lot. I'm always kind of mixed on him, but this is the role and the performance that will always make me, when I question if he can actually act, I always think of this and I'm just like over the moon about it. I mean, I wish he had got the nomination. I wish he'd won this year. I think he's that good. So, yeah. And not to say that Delon is bad, I just think Damon does wonders with this.
Yeah, they're not really comparable interpretations of the character, aside from like the literal things that they find themselves doing, like forging signatures and forging notes and that sort of thing. They do play it very differently. Delon is like a more European interpretation. I know that sounds so stupid when the actor's French, but it definitely has that like dark bite that European actors like, and just like how French actors in particular love to be amoral. And you can definitely sense that sort of this sort of passion behind that. Whereas Matt Damon plays it for like a mainstream audience. He's playing like the most accessible form of manipulation and sociopathy. Yeah. So I do prefer Delon, but I also came across this like funny Quora question that was like, why didn't Matt Damon win an Oscar for The Talented Mr. Ripley? And the answer was like, well, the Oscars are a popularity contest, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, you know, you can't always answer things like that. The next comparison, and it's the final one we'll do, so mild spoilers here. Which one has the better ending?
I think just because it's the most fresh in my mind and I had forgotten how the ending worked in Talented Mr. Ripley, I think on this comparison, I'll have to go Ripley. I think I kind of appreciate the not showing of the murder this time around. I think it's a much more artistic choice in having it done through audio. And you can, while it's done through audio, you can see it in your mind how it's playing out. So I think I'd go with the 90s version.
Purple Noon is the ending that you want or you need to be nominated for the Academy Award, because it's that moment where you see justice will be served in the sort of unjustifiable actions that this character goes through. Whereas the Talented Mr. Ripley ending is a little bit more sordid and almost like Nightmare Alley-ish, and then it's just bad for everyone. So at the Oscars, Talented Mr. Ripley was nominated for 5, didn't win any, which is interesting because I feel like if it was a Best Picture nominee or a Best Director nominee, it also would have gone home empty-handed. So now we're going to go category by category through the nominations. I'll mention the category and the nominees, and we basically are going to choose who we think or who our winner is. Starting off with Best Costume Design, where the winner was Topsy Turvy, and the other nominees were Anna and the King, Sleepy Hollow, and Titus. Haven't seen any of those nominees. I have seen Topsy Turvy, and that's a great Mike Lee film. I guess Topsy Turvy has like, you know, the true period design, like we're turn of the century, not mid-century. So I can see why they went for that. Also has like the Japanese elements. That's a fairly decent winner. And yes, it feels very luxurious, rich. And like, I still remember the tuxedos from the film, just felt so authentic. The wardrobe in The Talented Mr. Ripley is like good, is like constantly good, and then sometimes it's like great. Like when they're at the opera, like Kate and Gwyneth are wearing like fantastic gowns. And even just like the men's style is just very sleek and also would be hard to pull off. Like there's, you know, I think you need like very just attractive people to pull off those clothes, and they are, and it works.
Yeah, I mean, Ripley has such great costume, even down to the swim trunks that they wear at the beach. I mean, that kind of
the highlight very green.
Yeah, like you think it wouldn't work, but I don't, it just is so well worn by Damon in his, as I've said, peak hotness era. I think on this occasion, I mean I've seen all five of the movies, and then The King is just again another adaptation of the same kind of King and I story. Sleepy Hollow, we all know the name Sleepy Hollow. Titus is just a Shakespeare adaptation, a Judy Taymor take that's really good. But I think Topsy Turvy is, I agree, the Academy made the right decision of these five nominees. I think there's a lot of costume there, and as you said, it's very period. And while sometimes I don't like, I always try to not vote for the period choice because it's always the one that wins, I think Topsy Turvy is just so well done. And while maybe not discussed as much as Ripley is, I think deserves to be discussed. I think it's a, again, another great film from 99 that more people should be talking about. Yeah. It's a Mike Leigh, unlike very many movies he makes. He's much more focused on contemporary conversation.
Yeah. And so best art direction, Sleepy Hollow won, Anna and the King, The Cider House Rules, and Topsy Turvy were the other nominees. And I wouldn't give Talented Mr. Ripley a win here. It's not as memorable as The Wardrobe, and it's also very real, if that makes, you know, like we're looking at real locations for the most part. But perhaps like Topsy Turvy, just for its recreation, especially of just like backstage theater at the time, you know, it's very impressive to look at the actual auditorium, but just the way, you know, England at that time, or London at the time, was just very dirty. I think it just reflects the wealth disparity really well when you see Gilbert and Sullivan's homes and just like, yeah, no, it's just a very well-designed film, and Topsy Turvy would have my win here.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree. I think Topsy Turvy should have won here. I guess just to speak a bit about Sleepy Hollow, there's good design there, but it's so kind of typical Burton at the time. And then I feel like Sleepy Hollow was the beginning of the kind of expected and, for me, boring design choice that Tim Burton would continue to make and continues to make to this day. It's nice to look at. It's an odd win when you think about the film's place in kind of conversation and how it's not fully always talked about. So I guess I can understand seeing that as a great design art direction wise, but I think, as you mentioned, Topsy Turvy has so much going on, and similar to the costumes, it's so great to watch as well. And while Ripley has a lot of great design, I'm more thinking it's great location finding, possibly, in these kind of magnificent villas, these magnificent homes, and a lot of it is in the streets. So I'm not sure if...
So it's like an Oscar for location scouting and less an Oscar for art direction. The original score one's interesting. So our winner was The Red Violin, one of the most idiosyncratic winners in this category. American Beauty, Angela's Ashes, and The Cider House of Rules were the other nominees. And it's like, just give it to American Beauty. It's just an iconic score. Plays into just the musical atmosphere of the time with its electronic elements and the synth elements and the way it combines classical music. Thomas Newman, we now know, is like very Oscar-less. He should have won an Oscar for here, and I think the expectation was that he would win the Oscar.
Mm-hmm. I'd have to agree. I think it's based on how overly appreciated American Beauty was this year, it's still shocking all these years later that this didn't amount to a Newman win. And I feel like ever since, Newman has been kind of stuck in the same universe in his scores. I think obviously the American Beauty score is so iconic. It's used in so many kind of publicity trailers. And when you hear the notes of the score, you're like, oh, that is the American Beauty score.
So adapted screenplay, our winner for some reason was The Cider House Rules. And the other nominees were Election, The Green Mile, and The Insider. I am torn between Election and Ripley for this one.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally understandable. The Cider House Rules is such a hot, not, I mean, it's just a really boring choice.
I really hate The Cider House Rules, so whatever you want to say about it, go ahead.
I just don't like wasting my breath on complaining about it, because I mean, The Cider House Rules is, I get no, like, it's, you know, it's bad. Well, if you are of the right thinking, like you and me are, you don't enjoy it. Election, I'm so happy this nomination happened. I wish more nominations happened for the film this year, but at least it has this one. But I think I go for Ripley on this occasion, only slightly over Election, and even to a lesser extent in The Insider. I think, as we've discussed, Ripley, at least in this adaptation, takes some risks. I mean, obviously I've never read the source material, but it takes a lot of risk with the characters, and definitely is a different type of adaptation than even Purple Noon was at the time, with how I've mentioned about kind of how dumb Tom comes across in his trying to lie and cheat, and how there's some very well-delivered lines by, I mean, we didn't really discuss him. We only mentioned his character of Philip Seymour Hoffman's Freddie Miles. There's just so much to like there. And that's why it would be my choice this year.
I know there are some people who just really dislike contrived scripts. And The Talented Mr. Ripley is definitely a contrived screenplay, but it works so well in the film's favor. And there are so many like moments of dialogue that are sort of like hooks that, yes, are very on the nose, but also just like, I kind of just want to applaud because they work so well in the context of the scenes. I think it's like it's an adaptation that makes you want to read the novel. And I think those are the ones that work the best. So Best Supporting Actor, where Jude Law was nominated, alongside Michael Caine in The Cider House Rules, who won, who I will just say now is the worst of the bunch. Tom Cruise in Magnolia, Michael Clark Duncan in The Green Mile, and young Haley Joel Osment in The Sixth Sense. For me, I have trouble choosing between Cruise, Duncan, and Osment. And who's going to get the edge on, like, today? Let's see. I think I'm going to go with Tom Cruise this time.
Okay.
Yeah. Although I have something positive to say about everyone except Michael Caine, who delivers the most boring, just, like, by-the-books, fruitless interpretation that is so beneath Caine's skill. And it's just such a predictable Miramax vehicle, like, just to win him another Oscar, which like really did not need to happen.
No. Yeah, I mean, the best thing to come part of this whole Michael Caine winning was the moment in his speech where he praised all other four of the nominees, whether it's telling Tom Cruise to stop being a supporting actor because he'll get paid less money, or calling out Jude Law as like the second coming. I mean, knowing that 5 years later, Jude Law would play Alfie in the 2000s adaptation, the role that kind of made Michael Caine famous, is funny to think about. I have to agree, Caine is such a nothing win. I mean, it's one of the worst for me because I'm so bored by Caine in this film. And the other nominees are so much stronger that if Caine were not there and maybe a Christopher Plummer in The Insider had gotten in instead, I think this would be easily one of the better assembled lists for a supporting actor.
Which is interesting because supporting actor is, at least in my opinion, the least interesting acting category most of the time, especially when you look at the winners. I mean, the 60s and the 70s, they just really awarded it to old men who, for some reason, they liked. When I look at Jude Law in The Talented Mr. Ripley amongst all these other nominees, I think that's like a very... He's a crucial anchor point for the film, and he's not a co-lead in disguise. He's still a supporting character. And I think that's the most that a supporting character can do before they become a lead. And it's very well executed. Tom Cruise, I'm impressed because it's like a side of him that you don't really see, at least on film. Who knows about his private life? Michael Clarke Duncan, I'm just like amazed how that performance just goes straight for the jugular, and it just really just captures you. And then I think Haley Joel Osment's performance is one that I just admire. Like, I'm just, I don't get how a child was able to grasp the maturity of this role and pull it off with more tact than most adults could.
Cruise is good. I think there are better performers in that same movie. I think Philip Seymour Hoffman is doing such better kind of understated work in that film. I mean, just thinking about, I think Philip Seymour Hoffman should have been here for anything.
Julianne Moore should have been nominated for Magnolia in supporting actress just for the pharmacy scene. But you even have Philip Baker Hall in Magnolia, who was also in Ripley. So you had, I think it was just 99 was just such a good year for film and for Hollywood, especially when we say 99. So, you know, there was just an abundance of films and prestigious films available.
Absolutely. I mean, even you mentioned Julianne Moore, she was in so many things this year, whether it was An Ideal Husband opposite Cate Blanchett. I mean, these people were kind of everywhere.
And when they're big Oscar players as well, it's funny, like this year you have, well, 2021, you had actors, well, an actor like Adam Driver, who was in lots of films, but he won't be nominated for an Oscar for any three of them. And Andrew Garfield, who maybe will pick up one nomination from a huge selection of films. It's interesting just seeing how in The Talented Mr. Ripley, the actors and what their projects are nowadays. I think Cate Blanchett is the one who's laughing all the way to the bank and back. Paltrow is now, well, we know what she's doing. We don't have to get into Goop. You know, well, Matt Damon was in The Last Duel, but we have Jude Law being in films like The Nest. And
yeah, I think while he's maybe not in as many mainstream projects as, say, a Damon, I think he's clearly proven again and again why he's the greater actor. I mean, if I were, I really love him in Anna Karenina from a decade ago. And I think seeing that performance opposite Ripley, you see the diversity of his acting, where he's playing such a kind of sexually motivated character in Ripley and then such a kind of asexual character in Anna Karenina. And just to see the different eras of his career. But I guess to get back to my choice in the category, I think it's pretty clear that Law is my winner. I've said it here. I'll keep saying it. Whether it's this list of men or my own list of men, I can't make a choice other than Law. I think it's a definitive performance. It's iconic for a reason for me. He does so much with so little screen time. And I think were this to have amounted in a win. I wonder the direction that Law's career might have gone in. I think it may have gone in the better versus what the immediate career looked like for him post this nomination.
Moving on though, what do you think of, just if you could like sum this up in a thought instead of going film by film, what do you think of the 1999 Best Picture nominees? And then more to that point, what are your top five for 99?
As I've mentioned earlier, it's a very disappointing list, I think, of 99 pictures. Mm-hmm. There's so much greatness in the year, and for it to amount to these five films, I mean, mainly two of them and to a lesser extent, kind of a third, I understand they're well-known pictures, but they're just not what do it for me this year. I mean, I guess to go over my top five films of the year in kind of no particular order, they have to be Kimberly Pierce's Boys Don't Cry, Almodovar's All About My Mother, Spike Jones and Charlie Kaufman's Being John Malkovich, PTA's Magnolia, and then number one of them all is Ripley.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong about 99's Best Picture being a fairly poor representational mirror to that year's strength in film. The Best Picture winner at the was American Beauty, which is a film that I had to study for English class and maybe watched upwards of like, I want to say 15 times within like a term, a school term. This was pre, Me Too. So it was a film that I had evaluated so many times that just naturally you feel more obliged to praise it because you notice more things. At the time, it was a film that elicited laughs from, a high school audience. I was like, wow, this is like the greatest film I've ever seen. But, that's not necessarily the case now. I do think it's still a strong film, although I haven't seen it for quite some time, upwards of, 6-7 years, I want to say. So I'm probably not the best, and I don't really want to rewatch it because of obvious factors. So I do think it is like a solid film for just how theatrical it is and for Benning's performance, for the score, and just for like a really English take on an American social problem and like how a newbie director to film sort of interacts with that medium. I freaking hate the Cider House Rules, and the Green Mile I think has a huge like clunkiness. It's not a good film, although like I know it's very highly rated on IMDb. Well, The Insider has a fantastic score, and it is a compelling sort of political drama, although the lead performances in my opinion are pretty lacking. Such a Michael Mann film. I think that's just, it's within its own definition. And The Sixth Sense is, a film that was spoiled to me by the time I had watched it, but I was still like surprised as if it was the first time. My top five for 99 are American Beauty, David Lynch's The Straight Story, Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia, which is probably my favorite of the year, Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut. And then my final one is Pedro Almodovar's All About My Mother. They had so many options. This would have been a wonderful year for 10. It's still an interesting Oscar year because you did see these films that we discussed get recognition somewhere. I mean, Eyes Wide Shut is the only one on my list that wasn't even nominated, although I do think it should have been nominated for cinematography and picture and director, and I can keep going, but it's interesting. I do think the best film of the bunch won. That's what I'll say.
I love a lot of the choices you made there as well. Eyes Wide Shut is probably my number six of that year, so it's quite close to making my top list, and I'm happy to see that All About My Mother also makes your list. I think in a time where we are now, where more international films are getting more mainstream, more main category nominations, I wish maybe that trend had begun 20 years later and Almodovar could have really exploded for this year. I'm at least happy that we have the international, the at the time foreign language film win. It's one of those kind of Oscar moments that I'll always think of, just like the genuine excitement and joy and kind of out there-ness of the actors awarding such a great collaborator of theirs. Mm-hmm. I will always watch that moment in a GIF or a video and just like be, have the biggest smile on my face.
I would be nominating Mr. Ripley instead of Cider House Rules. So like, I mean, The Talented Mr. Ripley just works as the best picture nominee for that year. And it did have a healthy reception at, you know, the Globes, the BAFTAs in particular.
Absolutely.
So thank you for joining me again, Owen. It's been a pleasure. Would you like to tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, no worries. Thank you for having me again. I guess you can find me mainly on Twitter, at Owen Daly. And then on Letterboxd, just kind of posting about the films that I've been watching recently. Yeah, it was fun coming on and talking about another Highsmith adaptation, another film that I love.
And you can also listen to our Carol episode from last year. Carol was an episode where we sort of just like endlessly agreed on the same thing, which is very like entertaining to have that echo chamber. I could talk about Carol endlessly, and I was very happy to actually talk about it endlessly at the time. So yeah, but no, thank you for joining me. Yeah, so you can find Out of Oscar Podcast on Twitter at Out of Oscar Pod, and you can also listen to it wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye.